Memorial Union Theater World Music Series. We're hearing a tune called Jigwene from Na Afriki, a tune she wrote expressing her admiration for all the women in her life. And before that, Sali Sidibe did Jen Magge, which translates as Transitory World, from Wasilu Foley on Stern. And we start off with Geoffrey Oyema doing Exile from his CD of the same name on the Real World record label. We'll have the BBC News coming up in about 30 seconds, followed by a public affair. And on today's public affair, host Alan Ruff's guest will be economic historian Michael Perlman, author of The Invisible Handcuffs of Capitalism. I'll be back next week with more music from all around the world. In the meantime, if you want to know more about the music I played, you can contact me at diaspora@terrio.org or go to my website at diaspora.terrio.org. Otherwise, have a good week.
BBC News with Ian Purden. Syrian opposition groups have called on President Assad to resign immediately and make way for a transition to democracy. It comes as Syrian troops and tanks continue operations in the town of Rastan, where more than 50 people are reported to have been killed. Jim Muir reports from Beirut.
Rastan has been cut off and under attack by troops and tanks for several days now. Conditions for civilians trapped there are reported to be dire. Activists said the town's been under heavy bombardment from artillery and tanks, with some houses being brought down on the heads of families. A four-year-old girl is reported to be among the many who've died. The authorities say they're pursuing armed terrorist gangs, and there are some independent reports that armed resistance is being met. All of this is going on despite the conciliatory gestures being made by the regime. It's released hundreds of detainees after an amnesty was announced, though thousands more remain.
Fighting is getting worse in the Yemeni capital Sana'a between President Saleh's forces and armed tribesmen. Thousands of tribal fighters are reported to be trying to force their way through government lines in the north of Sana'a. The BBC's security correspondent Frank Gardner reports.
It's exactly the sort of breakdown of law and order that President Saleh predicted would happen if he was pushed from power. But his many critics say he is to blame after promising to step down, then going back three times on his word. Even the president's former allies, Britain and the US, are pushing for him to leave. Yemen's Gulf Arab neighbors have arranged a deal that would see him step down within 30 days in exchange for immunity from prosecution. But President Saleh still has some loyal supporters, and he appears determined to cling to power, at least for a while longer, at whatever the cost to his country.
The World Health Organization says the deadly food poisoning outbreak in Germany is being caused by a highly toxic strain of E. coli that has never been detected before. The WHO said it appeared to be a hybrid of two different bacteria. Russia has banned the import of vegetables from the European Union to try to stop the illness spreading there, a move that a spokesman from the European Commission, Frédéric Vincent, has called totally unacceptable.
What the Russians are doing concerns all EU products at the moment, and we don't think it's the right move. We think this is disproportionate, and we have a safety system in the EU which is working. We do have a health situation at the moment in Germany, but we're dealing with it, and we're going to sit down and discuss with the Russians to explain again the safety of our system.
The outbreak has killed nearly 20 people and made more than 1,600 ill. The Indian government has approved plans to provide the country's many millions of slum dwellers with adequate housing and sanitary living conditions. It says it wants to see slums eradicated by 2017. The government is putting up an initial $225 million to help to fund the programme. World News from the BBC.
And you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, and WORT HD.
The Caravanistas are coming. On Saturday, June 4th, a kickoff benefit extravaganza will be presented by the Grassroots Caravan at the Just Coffee Warehouse and Parking Lot at 1129 East Wilson from 2:30 to midnight. The event will feature amazing music by Little Red Wolf, the Takai All-Stars, and Screamin' Sensen and the Ponds.
But wait, there's more.
All afternoon, all aspects of bicycle culture will be celebrated. There'll be fabulous prizes and a raffle, a giant Hummer pinata, solar oven and bike mechanics workshops, and food available from Madison's finest restaurants. The sliding scale entry fee and all money raised will help cover the camping, food, and support vehicle costs for the solar ride. For on June 11th, the Grassroots Caravan will be taking off from Madison and traveling to Custer, Wisconsin for the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair on June 17th to the 19th. But to kick off this trek, that's Saturday, June 4th from 2:30 to midnight at the Just Coffee Warehouse and Parking parking lot at 1129 East Wilson. Keeping you informed of the pedal-powered experience, WORT 89.9 FM in Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and ResTech Services, a locally owned and operated internet, digital phone, direct TV, and low-voltage wiring provider for multi-dwelling communities and businesses. On the web at restechservices.net or by phone at 608-663-3868.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. With us on the phone from California is Michael Perlman. Michael Perlman is an economist and economic historian, currently teaching at California State University at Chico. He's the author of numerous books, 18 or 19 at this point, including such titles as Railroading Economics, Manufacturing Discontent, The Perverse Economy, and numerous others. He's been on various media, various radio stations. He's been on Media Matters and Pacifica Radio, KPFA in Berkeley, WBBR, the Bloomberg Radio. Today we're going to be talking about his latest book, and the I must say, right at the start, it's a very rich, wonderful read at numerous levels, very layered book, and we're going to be talking about a number of themes this hour. His latest book, The Invisible Handcuffs of Capitalism, How Market Tyranny Stifles the Economy by Stunting Workers. Michael Perlman, welcome back to WRT. It's been some time since I've been able to have you on.
Yes, it's a pleasure being back.
It's good. I must say, as I just I just mentioned, that I've read a number of your books, and this one I think is really one of your best. And I want to congratulate.
Well, thank you very much.
I want to congratulate you on it at the start. The title. Let's start.
Let me close my door for a second.
Door closed?
Sorry about that.
It's okay, Michael. Let's start with the title because, of course, it's a marvelous play on Adam Smith's phrase about the visible hand of the market. You're talking about the invisible handcuffs of capitalism. Those handcuffs are very complex, and locked very tightly in many ways. Let's start right with that title, The Invisible Handcuffs. Let's lay that out a little bit.
Well, Adam Smith talked about how the economy worked as if there were an invisible hand guiding everything so that the whole system would work to everybody's benefit. And, of course, the system is rigged. And it's rigged in many ways. And first of all, it's rigged intellectually in the sense that very few places other than WRT are able to speak about the economy in terms of the power and conflict involved in making it run. Secondly, it's invisible in the sense that what the workers do is voluntary in the sense that you have to have a job in order to eat unless you inherit a great deal of money. But at the same time, that necessity forces workers to take a job. Even more important, once they're in the job, the work is guided in a tyrannical sense, in the sense that you must comply with the orders of the worker, of the employer, or you are canned. Finally, and perhaps this is most important, is the system of power and control is such that it makes it much more difficult for workers to get the type of intellectual development and human development that would make it possible for them not only to be better people, to lead better lives, but also to contribute to the economy. So I try to talk about the handcuffs on these various levels.
Of course, in mainstream economics is taught macro and micro level
at major institutions across the U.S. and globally, for that matter. The economy is always talked about at the level of exchange or circulation. That is, buy right, buy dear, sell right, or whatever. Buy cheap, sell dear. And work, there's this constant refrain through your book about how workers and work and working relations are dropped out by mainstream economists. Why is that?
Well, it's ideological. That is, when you deal, what economics does do is it frames everything in terms of voluntary transactions. So when you have voluntary transactions, everybody's made better, presumably, and there is no coercive nature of these transactions. It also means that since everybody's better off, each transaction represents some sort of a social improvement. Hidden from this is that by treating everything as a transaction, what you see is you see a worker, in terms of economics, entering into the gate, and then they immediately leave. That is, as if the time on the job elapsed instantaneously. They pick up their paycheck, and that's the end of it. The workers are bought just as you'd buy coal or steel or any other input, and just as we don't talk about the treatment of coal or steel in the production process, we don't talk about the treatment of workers. So ideologically, it makes a good deal of sense to talk about things in terms of transactions because it removes any sign of or symptom of conflict and contradiction within the entire system.
We're listening to Michael Perlman, author of The Invisible Handcuffs of Capitalism. Michael Perlman, running through your book is a discussion of what you term a Procrustean system. You talk about the legend of Procrustes very early in the book to set up your arguments or to call the system by yet another name. Tell our listeners about that legend, about that myth of Procrustes.
Well, Procrustes was presumably a innkeeper, and he had an iron bed, and each of his guests would be put on the bed, and their bodies would be adjusted to the bed. That is, if they were tall, part of their limbs would be cut off. If they were short, they'd be stretched to fit the bed. And the way the economy works is that we all have to fit what the economy demands. And these fits can be very painful. That is, you in Wisconsin have been seeing sort of macro fit of the Procrustean bed, in which every part of the economy is being adjusted to some almost mythical needs of the economy. And I argue that the whole structure of the way we talk about economics is mythological, theological, and has little to do with reality. But once you start accepting that structure about the needs of capital, the needs of this, then it's incumbent upon people, society, everybody, everything to fit, just as the Procrustean bed, regardless of the human and social costs of doing so.
You know, of course, the state here in Wisconsin and the state at the federal and, the global level as well, has always played a central role here. Of course, in the current period, numerous states within the U.S. are attacking workers at various levels. We've already alluded to that. What do you say to those who say that it's the state, the government, that is the problem, that after all, they impinge upon, libertarians argue that it's if the state got out of the way, the economy would function naturally.
Yeah, the libertarian argument would treat the one conflict that they do see as a conflict between the state and the individual. And most people who would listen to this radio station, I assume, would assume that the big question is whether the state is an appendage to the corporate sector, or whether the corporate sector is an appendage to the state, which is a tail and which is a dog. So it's not that the state is at fault. In fact, the real fault is that the state has been inhibited both by political influence and other and intellectual deficiencies. The state has been prohibited from doing what it could do to make the economy, make the world, make society better.
But of course, you also talk about the contradiction. You term it the cognitive dissonance. That is that quite often those in power, it's visible in the debates going on in Congress now about the fiscal crisis, the deficit, that they talk about basically getting the state out of the way. They abhor the free market, but nevertheless rely on the state. There's always that fantastic contradiction. You go on, you say. That no country has ever successfully developed on the basis of free markets, that there has always been state intervention, but yet those, again, especially conservatives, rail against the state.
Well, right now they're railing against the state on two levels. One is the deficit, and of course that's nonsense because their intention is not to cut the deficit, but rather to restrain the state spending in order to create more tax cuts, which will have no effect whatsoever on the deficit. That is, if you cut $1 billion from government spending, you give $1 billion in tax cuts, that's not going to do anything. But the deficit scares people. They think about all sorts of problems, and it's not really the problem that it should be. And most of the deficit that we have today is because of the failure of the economy, not because of the influence of the state. So, yeah, the cognitive dissonance is just extraordinary.
256-2001. Of course, the a target of so much of this attempt to, increase the rate of profit from these major corporations using the state or in the private sector as such has to do with the attack on unions, so visible here in Wisconsin and other places, across the planet. Why the attack on unions? Why are they unnerved by unions?
Let me shift to a different book.
Sure.
In the Confiscation of American Prosperity from Right-Wing Extremism and Economic Ideology to the Next Great Depression. Actually, I was predicting the Next Great Depression. It came out in August 2007, just when the stock market peaked. I tell the story there of how the U.S. economy prospered tremendously because of the sequence of the Great Depression, which wiped out a lot of the old obsolete capital, wiped out debt, and the Depression turned out to be one of the major factors in making the economy efficient. Productivity increased faster during the Depression than any other period. Then you had World War II, which restricted consumption because of the needs of the wartime machine. It created a lot of new capacity. It eliminated our potential competitors abroad. So you had a period, say, from 1945 up through the late 1960s, which economists refer to as the Golden Age. So profits were soaring there in a way that they never had before. During the Golden Age, however, they did virtually nothing to modernize the economy. They added capacity, but there wasn't much replacement of old capital. So while American capital aged, the foreign competition increased, and the economy, the rate of productivity in the economy started to go down, and then profits went down. And at that point, beginning in the late 1960s, there was a concerted effort to try to restructure the entire economy in order to capture what was an unusually high rate of profit. And to do that, they had to remove any impediment whatsoever. That is, the whole legal system was changed. The rights of unions were changed. Of course, course, you had the Taft-Hartley law, which preceded that, but the intensification of the fight against labor was seen as a way in which you could reinvigorate the economy by lowering the costs, that is, treating labor just as another input and giving an advantage to producers. So this begins, this also another part of this is deregulation, another part of this is government subsidies, another, you know, it was a total restructuring of the economy. But while that would give you some advantage, there was virtually nothing done to improve the productivity of the economy. What happened was that business, even industrial business, shifted to making money from finance. But making money from finance requires something on the ground, producing stuff that creates a profit. That is, finance just represents shifting stuff from one corner of the table to another. So labor wasn't the only objective. There were all sorts of objectives, deregulation of all kinds. But it's become so obvious now that now the attack on the public sectors, you know, the school teachers would almost seem to be, their union would almost seem to be an adjunct to Al-Qaeda, the way they're treated in the press. So the problem is there's been virtually no media or no Democratic politicians or anybody else who would speak sense to what was going on. As the Democrats, no matter what the Republicans will propose, the Democrats will say, well, let's go halfway there.
Compounded in part by, of course, by the trade union leadership, the trade union bureaucracies, and the unions largely being allied with and tied to the Democratic Party?
Yeah, the unions in the Democratic Party were almost like the pro-life people in the Republican Party. The Republicans would give little bits to the pro-life people, but the worst thing that could happen to the Republicans would be that abortion would be illegal altogether, because then the right-wing religious conservatives would have no need for the Republican Party. And I think something similar went with the Democrats. The Democrats liked the unions insofar as the unions would give them money, but they didn't want to do anything for the unions that would upset their own donors from big capital. So a very sad situation, sad dysfunctional situation. So that while you had your protests in Wisconsin, much of the rest of the country has sat back passively, unlike Europe, where people have responded much more vigorously. Because I think that the media there must be better in terms of informing people about what's actually going on.
Well, there's actually a much deeper political culture, that more diverse culture with a, excuse me, with a functioning left, with a left trade unionism, with left parties, and so on, mobilized, of course, through the so-called, what I call now the asocial media. 256-2001. Let's go to our first caller. We have several on the line already. Great. Hello, caller. You're on the air. Hello. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I wonder if you could give me, if you look into the signature of the current monopoly market structure in American transnationals, because what I've been reading is it's incredibly high, which just seems like an oxymoron. You know, how can you have with no competition? Yeah. And that leads to the second question.
Caller, you're breaking up there.
Pardon?
You're kind of breaking up. Are you on a cell phone?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, it's kind of, you're not coming through very clearly. Maybe if you hang up and call back, and then we'll go.
Okay.
And then we'll go to our next caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air. Yes, hello, caller. Hello?
Hello.
Yes, please.
Yes, I'm enjoying your program, but I'd like to take exception to the guest using the term pro-life. So the anti-abortion people are not pro-life. So I just wanted to put in that comment. Otherwise, good show.
Thank you I wanted to get to that. Thank you. You know, we're talking about choice. We're not talking about an anti-choice 256-2001. No, there's no one there at this point. Michael Perlman, we were going to, we were getting to this kind of, we're talking about the levels of, in a sense, voluntary servitude, that people internalize the handcuffs.
Yes.
They internalize it as natural, as the state of being, as, you know, you go through the book and you talk about how that constant refrain of the conservatives, that there is no alternative, that the TINA, T-I-N-A of Margaret Thatcher, you know, ever since, it's as long as capitalism. But you talk about the self-imprisonment of workers, that voluntary servitude. You talk about the ideology that permeates all of us. Go into that some, the level of consumption, the level of having to work, the compulsion, and so on.
Okay. Let me make a comment on the last caller's.
Please, please.
About pro-life. I use pro-life intentionally because I was talking about the relationship between the Republican Party and the anti-choice people. So
okay.
It was intentional, but it was intentional in terms of the context in which I was talking. In terms of the self-imprisonment, which is very, very important, first of all, this was something that economists have been trying to cultivate since the early 1900s, that is, since the late 1800s, actually. And the problem was, in the late 19th century, there was a growing fear of labor militancy. You had people like Debs running for president from a prison cell and still doing quite well. So the idea became important to push that workers should identify not as a worker, but as a consumer. There was a great deal of propaganda pushed in this respect. And they were, over the long run, very successful, in part, I think, because of the success of the Golden Age, when people did increase their consumption a great deal and enjoyed their consumption. And part of the reason this was successful was that the stifling conditions of work are such that many people really can't find fulfillment in what they're doing. So the idea was, well, you should look for your fulfillment after you work, when you go home and shop. And eventually, once you start doing that and your whole community starts doing that, there's the need to keep up with the Joneses and then a need to pay your debts. We saw the dead end that that kind of life led to with the big collapse starting in 2007. Now, can I take a moment and respond to what the first caller asked about the monopoly?
Sure.
Okay. One of the things that I discuss in a different book, Railroading Economics, was the idea that in a modern economy, what you have is a very, very small cost of production. You may have big overhead costs in producing the capacity to produce, but the actual cost of production is very small. And this is in, you see this in the cost of pharmaceuticals and computer software in terms of music. It can be reproduced very cheaply. The first people who started looking at this in the United States were coming out of Wisconsin, who were talking about the need for public goods. That is, because competition will drive the price down to the marginal cost, and the marginal cost will be insufficient to pay the average cost. Is that too technical, do you think?
Go into that a little bit more deeply for our broader audience.
So I could go into business selling Windows software, and it would cost me, you know, a few pennies to make a piece of software and to distribute it. So if I were to be able to compete with Windows, then Microsoft would not be a very prosperous business. It would go bankrupt. Same with pharmaceuticals. And economists first started seeing this with the railroads. That is, the cost of taking a ton of freight was very, very small. So if you had two railroads operating in competitive condition, they could never make it. So the late 19th century, you got a consolidation of business in order to prevent competition. So when you prevent competition, then you prevent the incentive to modernize. That's why in the Golden Age, I mentioned, there was very little modernization going on. the nature of modern technology is that competition becomes impossible in a profit-making context.
So it's
really... While the right wing, the libertarians talk about free enterprise and this and that, they know that would cause a terrible, terrible problem in the economy if there were competition. So monopoly is one way, government regulation is another way, but the death spiral, it would be the death of capitalist economy in a modern economy to have a really competitive economy. Despite the fact that that's the world that they describe, cognitive dissonance again.
256-2001. We have a caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Alan.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I really wish you would reduce the delay. I think that's what's causing a lot of confusing for callers.
There is no delay.
I guess basically my comment is this. I agree with everything your guest has said so far, as I usually do. But I'm going to raise the stock question that I always do in listening to these type of programs. There is no instance in history that I'm aware of money or property or assets voluntarily changing hands. And that being the case, I mean, what is going to be done to bring about the necessary reforms? I mean, in my own pessimistic viewpoint, I think there would be quite a bit of bloodshed required even to replace our present economic system with, say, the type that they have in Sweden or the Netherlands or even Germany. And I don't see that happening here, at least not without violence. And I guess my question is, what do you propose to bring about the economic reforms that are necessary? How are they going to be brought about? And do you think violence will be required? And I'll take my answers off the air. Thanks for taking the call.
Thank you, caller.
If violence occurs, it would most likely come from the powers that be rather than the powers that challenge the powers that be. Well, it's impossible. You know, it's very difficult for anybody to sit here and to lay out some pathway toward decent society. But when you see what's going on in some places in the Middle East, Tunisia, for example, to a lesser extent in Egypt, one wouldn't have expected if this question had been posed, say, a year or two ago, what do you do to propose to open up the way to something better in Tunisia or Egypt? I think most people would have been having a hard time finding an adequate answer. And I would have a hard time finding an adequate answer. But what we do know is that the kind of spirit that people showed in Wisconsin, arguing, protesting against what was going on, is what will be needed. How you get that kind of consciousness spreading throughout the country, I don't know.
Yeah, no, Michael Perlman, I think that what we witnessed here in Madison, especially during the heights of the mobilizations in February and March, was that people were beginning to take off the handcuffs.
Exactly.
That is, you come into... these mobilizations from your daily routine, your job, your family, your school, your whatever you're doing, and suddenly you're there with some kind of authentic community, some authentic kind of collectivity, and the educational process accelerates. People, there's these discussions and a discussion of politics, and there was again, the analysis of that it wasn't necessarily all just Walker or the Koch brothers, but that indeed it was this imposed austerity and this kind of economic belt tightening imposed upon the working class while there was tax breaks. It was very marvelous. I want to get back to something, a word that our last caller just used, because you discuss it in several places in your book. The appropriation, the co-optation of the notion of reform. Reform used to mean something quite different than the way that it is largely used today.
Yes, when I hear the word reform now, I cringe. And I was thinking just yesterday about how you can figure out a better word to describe reform. I wanted to say one other thing about Wisconsin, which is important about the change, and that is when the conservatives went after, say, the unions that would be represented, like the steel workers or the coal miners or the like, that didn't affect people directly. But now they've taken out most of the union power, and the union power that remains is the public unions. And when they start taking out the public unions, they're taking out services that people, that the government gives directly. It's not the indirect marketing of steel or the indirect marketing of coal, but they're talking about taking away the quality of private education, of public safety, of fire departments. And I think that made it clear to people about what was going on. When the other unions lost their power and when the jobs were shipped ashore, that was almost secondary. It didn't affect people in the same way.
I think it also has to do with a sense in this state that's come across generations of something that you're aware of called the Wisconsin idea. That is that government is there, the University of Wisconsin and the state capitol, the legislature and the executive, they're working hand in hand to serve the people of the state of Wisconsin. Wisconsin led the way in a long list of social legislation, of political reform, and there's that expectation of clean, transparent government, which has been usurped. So I think that's a very important part of it.
No, I agree with that. I've always been an admirer of the La Follette type of perspective that came out of the University of Wisconsin. And in fact, one of the less desirable progressives there was somebody who was probably a relative of mine. That was Selig Perlman.
Who knew?
Who knew? Well, he spells his name differently.
Yeah, yeah.
But his son told me that they changed the spelling.
256-2001. I want to get back to this theme of discipline, because you talk about that throughout the book at numerous levels, from the local to the international. The disciplining of workers, overt and covert. People, you know, the overt is obvious, the punishment. But there's also a kind of overt, a constant overt disciplining going on in the workplace, in the society at large, in the prisons. Let's talk about that a little bit.
It's totally important. It's very, very important, Alan. But it's also difficult, because the type of covert discipline that you see, you don't see directly, but you start in the schools. When schools aren't as bad when I was a kid, we had to march in lockstep from class to class. As one of the things that you're taught in school is obey, discipline. It's supposed to be part of education, and certainly there's a degree of discipline required, but discipline was very, very important in the way education was going. Those people who, I remember reading about one of the people who ran one of the conglomerates saying that he only hired people who had a certain level of education. And his reason wasn't because of the training, but rather that education, the fact that you could go through these steps in education showed that you had a certain degree of discipline and that you would then take orders in the office or on the shop floor. So discipline is very important. One of the important disciplining factors is, of course, the fear of losing your job and losing the status and losing this way of life associated with a particular job. The discipline comes from social types of discipline. That is, you if you want a particular type of job, you don't dress in a bad way. You have your hair done in a particular way. I went to school with a boy whose two brothers were in the NFL. He didn't have enough discipline to get in the NFL, so you can imagine the level of discipline. But his brothers ended up being working for IBM, and he didn't get a job in IBM. And the reason was he didn't believe his brothers that you had to wear black socks that covered most of your calf if you're going to apply for a job with IBM at the time.
Two fives.
I don't know what kind of socks he wore, but he didn't have enough sense of discipline. But the real difficult discipline is the self-discipline that happens when you absorb this kind of culture in which you accept things the way they are, you accept the hierarchies the way they are, you salute the president, you bow down before the governor. It's very destructive because it means that people, unless something dramatic happens, like Governor Walker's overstretch, people just sort of accept things as they go along. And then you have the old frog in the hot water where, I don't know if it's true or not, but where the frog stays in the water as the heat goes up just a little, just a little, just a little, until it starts to boil.
256-2001. You know, that leads to my next question in this discussion, and that is part of the same cloth of discipline, self-discipline, is deference. At some level, the demonstrations, the mobilizations here in Madison, there was a collapsing of deference. But at the same time, the demonstrations, the mobilizations up until this point have been locked in at the level of protest. That is a request for redress, a petitioning of the government. And within the demonstrations, there was even a constant deference to authority, to leaders, especially coming from the trade union and Democratic Party leadership, a deference to particularly what I would phrase as kind of middle-class morality, this business of shouting shame at the Capitol building as if it was a moral question, that if you could shame Walker and the Fitzgeralds into changing their tune. Again, the deference all along the way as an impediment to the kinds of, I would argue, the kinds of movement that would really be needed to change, to force concessions from, or at least to force back this offensive against the working class and the popular classes in the state.
I think you're absolutely correct. And of course, from afar, when we look at what was going on in Tunisia and Egypt, it looked like that kind of deference seemed to disappear, except for the deference to the army. And of course, the army was playing an ambiguous role in Egypt. But you're absolutely correct. And what happens, you see this in terms of crisis in military situations very often. What you'll see is that people rise to the floor who you would never expect to do that. That people has all sorts of, let me back up. Part of the story of the book is that people have the capacity to do all sorts of incredible things. I played basketball, and there was a Native American kid who lost the use of one side of his body mostly by being hit in a lacrosse game. And he could actually play basketball, even though he ran very, very awkwardly and could only shoot with one hand. It was incredible what he could do. A kid just won a national wrestling championship with one leg. Incredible what he could do. There's a little Hmong kid that plays basketball with us. I don't think he weighs 90 pounds. And it's, again, incredible what he... So what deference does is it removes that spark where people can see what they can do and can take advantage of it and find their own gift, their own spark. Because I know one thing I believe that's center of everything that I wrote, right, and that is that everybody in the world has the capacity to be the world's best at something, and the job of education, the job of parents should be to help that person find out what that gift is. And when you have deference, you don't have that same spark. That is, you see yourself as being inferior to the governor, the senator, the president, or whoever.
Yeah, I often counterpose the Thatcherite kind of Tina. There is no alternative. I counterpose with that the slogan of this World Social Forum's Another World is Possible. 256-2001, let's go to the phones. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Is that me?
It is.
Yeah, I was just thinking about all the protests in Madison. What really made change throughout history was strikes. And if the protest was really serious, they would just go on strike.
Michael Perlman, the weapons of the working class.
Yeah, this strike is a very powerful weapon. And again, going back to Egypt, the strikes were very important in allowing the government to back down, forcing the government to back down. And certainly, if had there been a general strike in Madison or anywhere else, it would have a major effect on the economy. There would be, in response to that, a great deal of repression, and the question of the outcome we wouldn't know. One earlier caller asked about violence, and I assume there would be a great deal of violence if there were a general strike, and I don't mean violence by the strikers.
Of course, it would
be coming from police, National Guard.
Right. Of course, it would shift the tactics of the police at various levels.
Yes.
Here, there are people in the crowds thanking the police and arguing that they're on our side, and the police will shift their tactics if the tactical moves of the protest move to a level of resistance and direct action. But, you know, the caller said something else. He said, you know, in that last phrase, he said, well, you know, if people want to get things done, they should just move to, you know, they should move to a general strike. And that gets back to our question of deference and discipline and a belief in the possible. I would argue that at least, you know, during those months, and it's not off the plate entirely, that a general strike wasn't possible because of, you know, what would be the withering of a kind of collective memory of a history of organization of capacities. People haven't realized their capacities yet, I don't think.
No, I agree with you 100%. And if you look at recent U.S. history, Richard Nixon's policies, many of them, were far to the left of anything that Clinton or Obama could imagine. Now, this wasn't because of the personal inclination or the personal preferences of Richard Nixon, but he saw crowds of people out on the street, and apparently some of the people who were with him said that it was crowds of people out on the street that caused him to signed many of the environmental legislations. He was frightened to death by the number of people who were protesting against the war.
You know, it came out in the Watergate tapes afterwards. There was all this talk, of course, that the Nixons would not be affected by the protests, that he was off at Camp David, and then we learned later on in the Watergate tapes that he was absolutely, you know, catatonic in regard to the demonstrations. There was one tape where he was actually peeking out from behind the blinds of the White House talking about the demonstrators. Why don't they go away? What are they doing? And we got to stop this. And, of course, that led to the break-in at Daniel Ellsberg's office and eventually the Watergate fiasco. 256-2001.
But it's not just the anti-war. It's the OSHA came about, the clean air, clean water, the EPA was strengthened. That people can have an effect. But like you say, it requires breaking down that barrier of deference.
256-2001. Our guest today is Michael Perlman. He's an economic historian at the California State University of Chico. An author of some, 18 or 19 books at this point, Michael?
19
books. How do you do it? Who knows? I marvel at you guys. The Invisible Handcuffs of Capitalism, How Market Tyranny Stifles the Economy by Stunting Workers, his latest book. Michael, there's a section in your book, and of course relates directly to some levels of activism going on here in Madison, and that is prisons. Prisons as a form of disciplining the entire working class. You talk about the class nature of the criminal justice system as, in a sense, the bottom line on it. If you don't conform, if you don't defer, if you don't discipline yourself, you're going to jail.
Yes. The editor of an earlier version of the book had me take out parts about the criminalization of homelessness. And I think it's very important, the criminalization of homelessness, because what it's saying is to a worker there, but for the grace of not God, but my employer, that would be my situation. And criminalization also helps to marginalize those people who might be less inclined to fall in line and do what they're supposed to and be the obedient worker and the obedient consumer. So prisons, yes, have a very, very big effect. And also they have a political effect, because the prisoners generally are, first, can't vote, and secondly, their votes do count even though they can't vote, in the sense that congressional districts are drawn according to population, and so the prisoners, like the slaves in the South, are counted as voters in the sense of districting, and they are not allowed to vote at the same time. So the prisons tend to be located in very, very conservative areas, rural areas, and therefore it gives a disproportionate power to that kind of district. Whereas the prisoners are removed from the districts that would be most likely to vote for a progressive. So it's all part of that same Procrustean system to try to force people to conform to the needs of capital, rather than have capital or the means of production conform to the needs of people.
And, of course, another theme, we have a few minutes left, another theme that is implicit in your subtitle, How Market Tyranny Stifles the Economy by Stunting Workers. The downside of this crazed system of control and discipline, and how it actually impedes productivity and progress in a broader sense.
Yeah, I think actually, Alan, that's the most important part of the book. That is, the capitalists see themselves as profiting from this form of pervasive control. But the net effect of it is that the economy becomes less strong. The economic potential becomes less strong. That is, the person on the assembly line, the person out in the fields, has the capacity to make real contributions. And you want to have a system that facilitates their development, their growth, and their ability to make these contributions that will make the economy, make the society stronger, better, and more appealing way of life. And instead, the worker becomes, because we deal with this in terms of transactions rather than what people actually do on the job, nature of work, workers, and working condition. And the net result of this is that we're all poor. But you don't see it immediately. And if one employer would let up on discipline, that employer may very well suffer. But to the extent that discipline would be reduced and then finally eliminated, we would have a much stronger, much better society.
We have like one more caller to come in before the close of the hour. Let's go back to the phone. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello?
Please.
Yes. Thanks, Alan, for this program. I agree with all the words your guest has said, but they're all in English. And Crow Dog, my brother, when asked, what is a tribe? The tribe is the language. And we're not talking about that. Afghanistan is not a series of tribes. It's a series of languages. The Kurds, okay? We're not talking about that.
What I was trying to do in the book is very similar, I think, to what the caller is suggesting. And that is that this Procrustean world creates a type of language, a type of mindset that makes it much more difficult for people to act in their own self-interest. So, yeah, I would agree with you. I'm hoping that I can get beyond English. I just did a paper in which I started with Molière's Bourgeois Gentleman, who is surprised to find out, to learn that he's been speaking prose all of his life. And we've adopted the language of economics in our culture. And it's a very destructive. It's a language that obfuscates rather than reveals anything. So I agree with the caller.
You know, and that of course gets to in some way to that earlier question of discipline in prisons. That is the law. You have that marvelous quote talking about language. That marvelous quote from Anatole France in your book about the beauty of and simplicity of the law.
Yes, it forbids the rich and poor alike from sleeping under the bridge at night.
What can we say? You know, and of course, that ties into this whole issue of the homeless. Across the history of capitalism, there's been this outlawing of the vagrant, the wanderer, the migrant worker, those that either by choice or by circumstance are outside the market, are marginal, and those folks, lots of those folks here in the mobilizations, because the emphasis has been on collective bargaining and union rights and so on, whole sectors, whole swaths of the working class, if you talk about the working class as being the employed, the underemployed, and the employed as well, whole swaths of the class get lopped off.
Yes. In an earlier book called The Invention of Capitalism, I have a long section describing how the game laws in England and in France were used, and it prohibited anybody from hunting. The idea was that all the game were the property of the king, and only those who the king chose by making them nobles and the like could be able to hunt. And what that did was it, in effect, prohibited self-sufficiency and made people have to go to the market. People operating outside of the market are a great threat to the system as a whole. So part of Procrustean-ism is to, again, create that Tina mentality. There is no alternative. There is no alternative because, of course, we aren't allowed to see the alternatives.
Well, Michael Perlman, it's been my pleasure this hour. I'm going to have to close it off there because
No.
I'm sorry?
No. I want to keep going.
Yeah. Well, if I had another hour, I'm going to have you back because I think while I've had you on before, I think this was the most productive and illuminating for me and our guests. But unfortunately, I do have to get into some important announcements about activism, about this revived mobilization that's taking place here this weekend in Madison, which I hope you'll see on the news or at least online anywhere, because the mainstream news will probably black some of this stuff out. But Michael Perlman, again, it's my pleasure, and I want to thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, I'll be back to you. Thank you. Yeah, I do have a couple of announcements here. The Join the People's Rights Campaign. Join firefighters and nurses, community people, farmers with their tractors. Stop Walker's Budget. That's Monday, June 6th, an all-day action taking place at the Capitol Square from beginning at 11:30. March from the fire station at 316. That's fire station number one at 316 West Dayton to the Capitol Square. Today, defend public education and in-state tuition rights. Join Voces de la Frontera, educators and students coming from Milwaukee and Racine. That's at the hearings going on. Oh, it just started about 12:45 in room 412 east of the state capitol. Say no to the assaults on public education. Today it's at 7 o'clock. Interfaith Vigil for a Just and Moral Budget, location at the Capitol Square, the State Street entrance. There's a bunch of things going on here. you can go to the various websites, Wisconsin Resists or Wisconsin Wave, various others, all posted on the Facebook. Things are going to, I think, people step up here once again. So get out, tell your friends, come on out. I want to thank Nigel on the phone, on the board, and Luke